As I was listening to you all come into the hall with your different ways of walking, you know, the little cat feet and then the thunk, 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 and then the kind of, you know, drag and the, you know, slow and the fast and all the rest of it, made me think of how many people have come in and out of this hall since IMS was founded. Thousands. Tens of thousands, I don't know. And then I thought about how often I've come in and out of this hall, thousands and thousands of times. Huh. And there's something about walking into the hall, walking through that walking room, as soon as I come in off the corridor there into, you know, the shoe room, my mind goes, shh. You're here, you're here, you're coming in again to this sacred place, really. We've had quite a few days now. I know for some of you it's been a bit of a wild ride. Oh, those minds, you know. So wild and so difficult to tame. The Buddha gives a number of different images for the untrained mind. One of the ones he uses is that of a wild tusker, which is, I guess, a male elephant that just kind of like rampages around and does what it wants. And, you know. Some of the images from different Buddhist traditions actually have a series of pictures where they depict this process of developing and training the mind as a series of images of animals and their relative tractability. And they all start with the same beginning kind of frame, which is it's out of control and it's doing its own thing, and maybe there's a little human somewhere in the picture that's like running after it trying to figure out how to get it to respond to what they would like to do, or maybe even just trying to get it to stop so the human can catch up to it and try to get its attention. So far this week we've been working with this wholesome state of metta. And the understanding in our tradition, of course, is that this is an important quality of mind in many different ways. And in my first talk I discussed the through line in the Buddha's teachings of the Eightfold Path and how starting with this discernment of the unwholesome and the wholesome qualities of mind, that, and then moving on to wise intention, the importance of infusing the rest of the practice path with this discernment about what it is that we're cultivating, but also this very wholesome, skillful, powerful quality of goodwill. And in our tradition, there's a whole set of teachings around what are called the Brahma Viharas, which are also called the heavenly abodes. Brahma Viharas, heavenly abodes. So Brahma was kind of the head god in the mythology, religious imagery and mythology of the Buddha's time. Brahma was the god that was closest to being in charge of what was going on. Although the understanding also was, well, he too was impermanent, and someday to his great surprise, Brahma would no longer be Brahma. But this idea that there was this realm where this being, from which this being exercised governance and control, was one that was at play in the imagination and imagery of the Buddhist time. So in this calling these states of particular states of mind the Brahma-viharas, there's a pointing to the fact that there are certain states of mind or certain quality of heart that can be developed to the point where they actually become a refuge of sort for the mind, that the mind can actually learn to dwell more and more fully internally in these realms of goodwill, starting with metta, and then can also learn to dwell in other related realms which are offshoots of metta or which support metta. So the four heavenly abodes, or the four Brahma-viharas, are metta to start. And then there is karuna, which is usually translated as compassion. Then there's mudita, which is translated as empathetic joy or sympathetic joy. And lastly, there's upekkha, which is equanimity, which is a kind of balance and steadiness of mind that arises out of wisdom, of seeing deeply into how things are. So in our understanding, in this tradition of Buddhism, metta is understood to be the first thing to be cultivated. So Oren gave a nice image this morning when he was talking about how in the practice of metta, you start where it's easy with the self or benefactor, and almost as if that particular pool fills up with metta, and then the overflow of that pool goes down to the friend, and the overflow of that pool, once it's full, goes to the neutral person, and so on. It was a lovely image. It pointed to the progressive nature of the development. So it's somewhat like that in the cultivation of these other Brahma-viharas, that you want to develop a foundation with metta, with goodwill, and then you can move on to separately develop and cultivate these other three, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. So for each of those other three Brahma-viharas, there's a particular set of phrases that you would use to help support your cultivation, and there's a particular suggested order of being that you would work with. So, for instance, the first being you would normally work with compassion would be somebody who's you're aware is suffering. And the phrases then would be something like, may you be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Right? You can see in that phrase that this is an example of this quality of caring, which is the nature of metta. But now it's being turned in the direction of a recognition that there's suffering here in this situation, and the heart-mind recognizes that, resonates with that suffering, and spontaneously reacts with the desire that that suffering be relieved. So it's sometimes described as a trembling of a responsive heart. And, you know, we could do multiple days of teaching and practice just with this property of compassion. And it would be time very well spent, because there are a lot of very interesting aspects to compassion. Some of which you might find rather surprising from our usual perspective. So, one example of that would be that compassion is actually a pleasant state and not an unpleasant one. Do you find that surprising, that compassion is a pleasant state and not an unpleasant one? So, you know, it's organically surprising, perhaps, because in order to practice compassion, we're actually turning our mind towards suffering, which means that we're allowing the fact that there is suffering, that there is difficulty, there is distress to fully register. But then the mind has enough stability when compassion is well established and purified that the mind actually doesn't get drug into the suffering. It doesn't get dragged down by the suffering. It doesn't lose its own sense of the safety of metta when it contacts those challenging circumstances in one's own experience or in the experience of others. So in that stability of mind there, you see the presence of equanimity, this fourth of the Brahmaviharas, that upon initial consideration you might go, what's that in there? Okay, I can see the other three, but what about that last one? What's that got to do with the other three? Well, that's the wisdom aspect that puts down a kind of psycho-emotional stabilizer that allows the other three to really be practiced in depth without the mind becoming unrealistic or imbalanced in how it's going about it. So the third of the Brahmaviharas, just to round out the description, so you will have heard this teaching on the retreat, is what's called mudita, which is known as empathetic and or sympathetic joy. And here is where this quality of metta or goodwill or care is actually turned towards the recognition of the happiness and success or well-being of a particular being, for instance. And instead of the mind doing what minds sometimes do, when you recognize somebody else has got something going on and kind of doing a little bit of recoil into envy or comparing mind or that kind of thing, instead, the expression of metta and recognition to somebody else's success is, right on, right on, right on, you know, may it continue. May it continue. May your happiness and well-being continue. May your good fortune increase. Those kinds of phrases would be mudita phrases. And interestingly enough, the cultivation of mudita is actually considered to be the most challenging of all. Is that a surprise? Not a surprise? It's a really wonderful practice and kind of a favorite topic of mine. But I'm not going to go into it more. So what I wanted to talk about is how these four qualities, when they're taken together, actually provide a pretty well-distributed toolkit for just about any condition that human beings can experience. So you've got the developed capacity to care, then you've got the response to suffering, then you've got the recognition of happiness and well-being, and then you've got stability to keep things on the rails internally. So these are very powerful internal assets. And they cover just about everything that you could meet in the course of a human life. Now, tonight I wanted to talk about an aspect of compassion and how it can help support forgiveness. I wasn't at Sharon's talk this afternoon, but when I came in, Oren said, Sharon's, somebody asked a question that kind of broached this subject matter, and Sharon responded to it and then said, Winnie's going to talk about that in her talk tonight. And I had planned to do it because it's a very interesting area, isn't it? There are a lot of religious traditions that touch on this area, forgiveness. Those of you who have been raised in, you know, religious traditions probably recognize this theme. Some religions more than others. It's a big theme in Christianity, I know for sure. Jesus was very big on this. I think one of his teachings was, you know, you should forgive someone 70 times 7. Am I right on that quote? I mean, that was a rather virtuoso act of forgiveness in extremis from the cross. You know, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Okay. That being was doing some powerful practice. That's what could be coming forward under those circumstances. So you could say this capacity to actually have a wise relationship to being on the wrong end of actions that cause suffering is a sign of spiritual development, spiritual maturity. And you could say that the recognition of being on the other end of the causes and conditions that result in suffering is can be a spur to greater understanding and spiritual development due to the realization that one has done some stuff that's caused harm and has formed the desire not to repeat that. So it's a potent area. And I know in the practice meetings, a number of you have talked about stuff that's come up, things that have come forward in the sittings for you, either a recognition of, oh, you know, I'm just realizing now, you know, I did something and I really wish I hadn't. I wish I could undo it. Or sometimes the other version is, you know, I'm having a lot of anger come up, or I'm having a lot of fear come up, and, you know, memories are coming up in relationship to some circumstance that happened earlier in my life, or some behavior by someone or someones that caused me harm. So then, how do we hold this whole area of investigation around the topic of suffering? So, just to start, imagine if there was, what it would be like if there was no way to be discontinuous with past errors or harm. Right? If there was no possibility of discontinuity or somehow breaking that chain of causation or somehow redirecting that experience, then we'd be in a situation where error would inexorably lead to more error. One harm would lead to repetition or retaliation. You know, and there are whole places in the world where civil structure has broken down, where, you know, it's basically in your own hands. You know, somebody does something to somebody in your family and, you know, you don't call the police, you know, you don't go to a judge and sue them in court, you know, you go to their house and you go back at them. So you can see, you know, that kind of framework, on and on it goes, because every time there's a that kind of retaliatory aggression, it feeds the next cycle, and there wouldn't be any way to stop it or to rectify it or to clean up the situation, or at least it wouldn't be easy. So in that case, once harm or damage was done, then it would resonate and kind of last way out into the future. You know, at some point, its natural half-life would start to manifest, and, you know, something else would start happening, and eventually it would zero out. But, you know, if you look at some of the most troubled places in the world, some of what's been going on, I mean, how far back? You could probably say that about every place in the globe, actually, if you knew the history. Some places the history are just more visible than others. But what can we do to find discontinuity? Find a way to do something different other than just being bound by this outflow from unskillful and harmful behavior? I think it's useful early in the examination to actually take a look at what we're talking about when we talk about forgiveness. So I'll give you a definition. This is my definition. As far as I know, it's my definition. You know how that is, you know, if you're a reader, but as far and a hearer, but as far as I know, it's my definition. But, you know, I'm sure there are many others that have many similarities to this. But so the way I hold it is that forgiveness is the process of developing a skillful, unstuck relationship to the past harmful actions of ourselves or others. It involves choosing the intention to forgive in order to end a suffering relationship to the story, to the people involved, and to current arisings that are related to it. It's a way to let go, disengage from continued harm, and from entanglement with suffering. So it's the exit, or the hoped-for exit ramp. So I'll read it again. It's the process, that's important, of developing a skillful, unstuck relationship to the past harmful actions of ourselves or others. It involves choosing the intention to forgive. So you hear the resonance about intention. The Buddha says intention always comes first for human beings. If you want to know the direction things are going to go, look at the intention. The intention to forgive in order to end a suffering relationship. Okay, the purpose of this is to end suffering. So this is actually an act of compassion, which is why I led in with the description of compassion. To end suffering in relationship to the story, to the people involved, and to current arisings which are related to it. So there's what happened, the event. There's the story about it, how the mind holds it, how it frames it. There's the people involved in it, and then there are the current arisings related to it, meaning how it's still operative in real time in your direct experience. So this may be operative in real time in your direct experience with things like memories, or it could be thoughts, or it could be resentments, or it could be emotions. But it's happening, it happened, but the resonance is still manifesting itself now, right? It's still alive. It's not the same thing that happened in the past, but that event that happened in the past is part of a set of causes and conditions that are now manifesting this, that you connect back to that. So forgiveness is a way to let go and to disentangle or disengage from continued harm and from continued suffering. So there's some other clarifications to make right at the beginning, which is about what it means to consider forgiveness and the process of forgiveness. Because that word forgiveness, we have a lot of associations with that. I bet if you folks had a piece of paper and I said, okay, I want you to just do a mind dump in relationship to this word. I want you to write down the first half dozen words that come to your mind when you think of forgiveness. Most of you would probably not have much trouble to do that. So we've got a mental model of it. And some of that, those associations we may have aren't particularly useful. And interestingly enough, some of these associations are actually in seeming opposition or contradiction with each other. So here are some that have come up for me as associations with this. Acceptance and letting go. Then there's regret, remorse, guilt, shame. Resistance, anger, withdrawal, rage, fear, judgment, condemnation. Freedom, peace, acceptance, renewal, reconciliation. Duty, obligation, putting on a false face, denial. Liberation, detachment, release, letting somebody get away with it. Right? Aren't all these kind of in the mix of the conversation which engages this word? So before we get into further clarifications about that, let's take a look at the reasons to practice it. Well, there's suffering in life, and sometimes we cause it. Right? Is this true? And in fact, I'll go further than that. I'd say there's no way that we can get through life or even get through a day without causing some suffering somewhere. Right? I was sitting over there a couple days ago in those side chairs near that plant, and I'm sitting near the plant, and all of a sudden I'm going, I'm not sure, but I think it feels like something very, very small is crawling on me in multiple places. Yeah, you may wish to move. I thought, oh, there must be like some little aphid or kind of like micro little animal over here, because I'm sitting here silently being a good meditation teacher and not moving, but I'm feeling stuff kind of and like and so on that level, you know, of micro damage, at least we're all causing damage, no matter how scrupulous we are. You know, even in India, you know, where you see people from the Jain religion wearing, you know, face masks so they don't inhale insects, and, you know, sweeping the ground in front of them so, you know, they don't step on tiny unseen beings. They're still doing some damage, because we have to, right? I mean, to eat a plant that somebody has harvested from the earth, you know, they're probably turning over the soil to do the planting in the first place. So there's a certain amount of damage woven into the fabric of the universe. So as conscious human beings, of course, we want to minimize that, right? Through our own actions, we want to minimize harm. We don't want to harm. With metta, we actually want to benefit people. But yet, there is harm, sometimes despite our best intention. And then sometimes we cause harm because we just screw up bad. You know. And then sometimes we have suffering inflicted upon us. And sometimes both things are true. You ever been in a relationship where it was a bit of a, you know, a train wreck where, you know, if you were simulating it in terms of, you know, an enemy or something of a boxing match, I mean, you know, you'd both come out of it looking pretty bad. And sometimes totally unintentional. right? Not even really, there was just something about the mix. You know, sometimes we're directly responsible for our own or others' suffering, and sometimes it just is part of life. And of course, our body-mind systems are geared to suffering, to notice it and to try to avoid it. So this is a really interesting paradox, which is the way we sometimes respond to injury and suffering is to never let ourselves forget it. In other words, to keep it alive. Isn't that interesting? It's like, that was so bad, that thing that happened. It's like, let me think about it again. You know, and just to be self-compassionate, too. We know that difficult memories are stored in a particular way that distinguishes them from non-traumatic ones. So they're stored with a lot of bells and whistles and flashing red lights that tell the heart and mind to watch out. You know, you better take care because, you know, something like this could happen again. So the result can be a kind of easily startled, easily revived fear, anger, fear response when something that even remotely resembles this arises, right? I was on the downtown train, and then a person of this type got on, and they gave me a hard time. And, now every time I think about going on the downtown train, I start looking around for a person of that type, and you know, I get scared, even though I'm not even on the downtown train. It's almost like the whole system says, you know, you better be on guard, you better watch out, you know, you better be prepared. And yet this pattern of keeping past suffering alive to prevent the future suffering is suffering in and of itself. So then there's the question of, well, how can we actually break the hold of suffering and sometimes our attachment to it? How can we open the mind to the possibility of freedom of living in the present with wisdom, with the past taking its place as the past? And the answer to that actually is the practice of forgiveness. It's helping to develop a functional instead of dysfunctional relationship to these experiences of wounding. And you can see the wisdom of that, because otherwise unskillful actions, whether they're our own or somebody else's, can create a kind of cul-de-sac where we're locked into an unwholesome, unskillful relationship with the present suffering caused by those past events. And in that kind of way, there's actually a painful an unskillful fusion to the very source of this suffering, whether that's a person or an event or an action. So in order for there to be a way to break ourselves free from this round and round of dukkha, which is a Pali word for suffering, there has to be something different, because the alternative is maintaining a tie of aversion to the person or situation which has caused harm. And sometimes that tie of aversion is to our own self with a particular kind of categorization that we've developed that includes us as the permanent prisoner of that description. So without this capacity, we can actually be bonded to our most painful experiences, closed around them, so stuck there. So the Buddha in the Dhammapada says something about the power of the mind in relationship to these experiences of suffering or difficulty. This selection is called Choices. It says, Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Live with such thoughts and you live in hate. Your own mind is replaying this episode. He did this. He did this to me. He hurt me in this way. He did this to me. He hurt me in this way. Live with such thoughts and you live in hate. Or another version of this, not from the Dhammapada, is, I screwed up in this way and I did this damage. I need to keep punishing myself for it because I'm a bad person. So forgiveness is the way out of entrapment in the wreckage of past unskillfulness. So it's a way to start again, to unstick what's adhered to suffering and judgment, to thaw what's been frozen and begin to let things move again and to release, to open choices, to open options, other than being chained to a cycle of reactivity to a memory of past experience. Now, it's really important to know that forgiveness is a process. It's a process. It's not just an act of will, right? I mean, we can make acts of will, you know, I forgive you. I forgive you. You know, and at a certain point in mind, the circumstances and the emotions might be so constellated that we can say that with sincerity. I forgive you. And yet, you know, we can't say, and I'll never be mad at you again. Not necessarily. But we can set the intention to continue to work with process. So this intention to forgive is essential. And it is part of a decision that's coming from wisdom. And you could say the decision is no longer attachment to the present results of the unskillful actions of others or ourselves. And this becomes possible when we start to recognize consciously that it's actually in our interest to let go, to no longer ignore a truth or tell ourselves the story in a way that gives us so much suffering. So there has to be a first recognition of suffering in order to help form the intention to find a different kind of relationship to it. So timing is very important with this. You have to be ready for the undertaking and to have enough stability of heart and mind and enough safety to undertake this practice. Right? Not always the case that those things are present. Sometimes it's actually premature to consider it. Sometimes we're still too involved with the original injury or still bleeding, literally or metaphorically. When that's the case, then the most important thing is to tend to yourself first and to restore your own safety and well-being. So often we can begin this process in a very gradual kind of way by, for instance, entertaining the possibility that we might at some point consider maybe forgiving, right? That's a step, and sometimes it's a very big step. Like, do you forgive him for all the things, you know, that happened in childhood? Your whole gut says, no, never. Maybe your wisdom mind says, not now. Maybe I'll think about it. Right? That's movement in that process. Maybe I'll think about it sometime. Right? That's definitely a step beyond the door is closed, the door is locked, the door is bolted, and I'm putting in a new barbed wire fence around the door. Now you've got maybe just like a little peephole in the door, you know. You put up just a crack, like one eye, just a tiny crack, slam it shut. Okay, that's the beginning. That's the beginning. You can start to work it from there. Now, there's a whole piece here about something that's important, which is the acknowledgement of error. The acknowledgement of error done wisely is really an important piece of this. Because forgiveness doesn't mean denial. It doesn't mean we minimize the damage done or blur accountability. Quite to the contrary. I mean, why doesn't that approach work? Remember I said earlier one of the resonances some people have with this word forgiveness is, you know, putting a face on it, or kind of like having to say, you know, oh, it's okay, you know, or oh, it doesn't bother me, or, you know, any of those things that can be socially lubricating in the moment, especially when there's pressure to not speak the truth. But really, that's not a foundation for releasing yourself from suffering in the way that I'm talking about. So, author Elizabeth Gilbert spoke on what she learned from her partner, Rhea Elias, who was a very interesting being, apparently. A woman who was born in Syria, and her family migrated to the U.S. when she was 8 or something, and she later became a punk rocker, which, you know, was probably quite an evolution from her parents' plans for her. But anyway, so this is what Rhea Elias has to. This is what Elizabeth Gilbert says about Rhea. Here is her mantra on truth. Quote: "The truth has legs. It always stands. When everything else in the room is blown up or dissolved away, the only thing standing will always be the truth. Since that's where you're going to end up anyway, you might as well just start there." And isn't that the case in these kinds of situations? We can't phony it because it won't work. We have to work with what's actually there as it's actually presenting itself, and not think that we can just plaster something over or skip around anything. So this idea of acknowledging error wisely, well, in many cases the original harm was done when basic sila, the precepts of non-harming, was forgotten or ignored. And then unskillful actions of body, speech, and mind cause damage. Isn't that the truth? And you think of the 5 precepts. Well, we took 6 this time, but the precepts that the 5 precepts that we took on the first night. You know, not taking life, not having wrong speech, not taking intoxicants, not taking what wasn't given, not indulging in sexual misconduct. What do you think the overlay between not observing the precepts and acts of harm is? Maybe not 100-100. But I'd say that they're pretty close, right? And the rest of the stuff seems to be random human miscommunication or expectation difference, or, you know, the way suffering is woven into how things are. I mean, we see in some of our own Buddhist communities some of the effects of this, right? You know, and sometimes among some people who have had teacher roles. So if, for instance, you take a community where a founding teacher has a history of substance abuse and boundary violation with students, and that's not addressed within the community, it's not acknowledged wisely, it's prematurely overlooked or forgiven, then you can have a circumstance where, for instance, in the second generation of that same community, you have the same kind of behaviors repeating, because nobody ever came to grips with the fact that the founder was an alcoholic and a sex addict. So it has to be named, right? So acknowledging wisely, it's very important. So it's good to be clear about responsibility. You know, we can acknowledge what we've done in ignorance and or what somebody else has done and not let the harm go unexamined. There's a certain kind of way, you know, especially when we want to hold things together, put things back together, that we can kind of like blip over the, you know, what the resulting train wreck actually is. And, you know, this has been the way, you know, a lot of things have been handled in our culture for a long time. You know, where the people who have been on the receiving end often have been encouraged to, you know, just kind of drop it and move on. And there may be wisdom in dropping it and moving on the part of the person who's on the receiving end. That may be actually part of what they wind up doing as part of their own forgiveness and healing process. But that shouldn't be an instruction from the person who did the damage. So, so it's important to learn to avoid harm by considering how the unskillful actions arose in the first place, what the causes and conditions were that led to the wrong action. So this is bringing in the power of reflection in order to seek understanding. So the Buddha himself, in a teaching to his son Rahula, told him that in order to purify thought, word, and action, we need to recognize and admit mistakes. And interestingly, he told his son that he should acknowledge the unwholesome action and to his teacher and actually open it, open this. In other words, not keep it hidden within his own heart or, you know, concealed from the person that was training him in the ways of non-harming and ethics. That it's better to like to acknowledge it, to put it out there. So to open this behavior, the fact of this behavior, or this issue with the teacher, and then undertake restraint for the future. So that's you know, so not just a Band-Aid slapped on it and then, you know, carry on. You know, especially if there's a pattern of a certain kind of behavior that is damaging either to ourselves or others, it requires investigation, right? Because it's arising because of particular causes and conditions, and it's very important to be able to identify what those are so we can look in the direction of what can be done to shift that or change that or to mitigate it. And then in terms of remorse and remedy, once we identify what we did which was unskillful, when we open to the harm that was caused by this action, we actually allow ourselves to feel why we don't want to do something like that again. Right? I mean, we've all done stuff. I mean, we've all done things where, you know, in retrospect we go, oh my God, what was I thinking? Oh man, was that stupid? Or was that selfish? Or was that heedless? Or was that... Right? We've all probably got some of those things. So the Buddha would say, wholesome remorse is actually good, because then that can lead you to resolve not to repeat it. So to make this kind of commitment to non-harming, to renew it, it's important to let the painful nature of it, of what happened, register. So then, if appropriate, we can take particular steps to refrain from or protect from future harm to ourselves or others. So this might involve things like, you know, getting psychological counseling or, you know, joining a recovery group or something like that, right? If every time you go out to drink, you get tanked and then you drive like that, or if... you know, you have a pattern of looking at online porn, and then before you know it, you know, you're meeting somebody someplace, and you know the person you're living with has no clue about this kind of thing. There's more going on there, right? There's a web of causes and conditions there that you're going to need to recognize and actually address before you're going to be able to successfully refrain from that kind of behavior. So if appropriate, we could make amends or restitution, or allow someone to apologize and make amends to us. Has anybody ever had the experience of... having somebody who was part of a train wreck some point earlier in your life look you up again and say something like, you know, I know you, we haven't talked in a long time and maybe you're not so glad to hear from me, but I'm in recovery now, and part of what that entails is acknowledging things that I've done and apologizing for them. Has anybody had that experience? No. And how did that make you feel when you heard that? Good?
Well, he felt good, but it was also... Mm-hmm. So when this came back...
Yeah. It can be healing in a certain kind of healing for you to allow someone else to do that. Now, that might not always be appropriate. Anybody had the experience of going to somebody else in this kind of way at some point and saying, I did something and I recognize how messed up it was? Yeah. And did it feel good to acknowledge that? To tell that truth? And no. There's always an outlier. It was tough. It can be tough. Yeah, it's tough. You know, because in a certain kind of way, you know, you're owning it. Right? It's like official once you own it in that way. But, you know, this is part of the process of releasing the tie to others that's got the nature of hatred and fear or resentment or guilt or shame. Now, there is some discernment that's required in all of this. Because guilt and shame are not what we're cultivating. They're not wholesome states. Right, so there's a way that we can take responsibility for our actions that actually isn't skillful. So this is to use our moral failings as proof positive we're bad and worthless human beings, right? In other words, to close our hearts to ourselves. It's like, I did this thing, I'm a shit. Well, maybe you were shit at the moment. But there's something about making yourself a permanent. Right? It was a moment in time. So, you know, this way of holding it, this way of claiming it, isn't skillful. And in a certain kind of way, it's actually on the self-centered end of the continuum, isn't it? Because instead of becoming clear about what behaviors we want to change, and then taking responsibility for that, we collapse into kind of a reverse narcissism that makes it all about us, right? Oh, I'm so bad. I'm so bad. So shame and guilt are suffering states, and we need to, and if we relate to them in unwholesome ways, that undercuts the real work, the work that needs to be done to liberate the mind and avoid future suffering. So getting caught in these disempowers the mind because it starts to lose confidence in its potential to evolve towards greater wisdom and goodness. Right? So we can be unskillful and marinate in our wrongdoings or lack of skill in a way that doesn't help. Now, once we make the intention to move towards forgiveness, we do an examination of the behaviors. We kind of look at what went into it. We acknowledge the harm. We kind of investigate that, and make a resolve to do different. Or when we've done some of that work in relationship to an injury that's happened to us. We've looked at the wisdom of forgiveness. We've looked at the importance of letting go. We've looked at, turned our mind in the direction of compassion toward ourselves and perhaps equanimity and letting go in relationship to the person or the circumstances that harmed us. We've done a good amount of the work, a good amount of what can be done. And it's also important to remain open to the truth of whatever continued present suffering there is. So even after working with forgiveness, there can still be experiences of arisings of anger or sadness or fear or remorse or guilt, right? Because it's not like a one-and-done kind of situation. Like you're using a whiteboard and you've written something on it and now you've got the magic eraser and it's, all gone. It's more like one of those sneaky pens that used to be around when I was a kid where, it had invisible ink and, you'd write on it and there'd be nothing there and then after a while, like, whoa, I can see the letters again. So, even after asteroids collide in space, they break down into smaller and smaller particles, but every once in a while, it may orbit through again, right? It's not the same thing, but often you would recognize, oh, it's this again, or it's related to this again. So the wise mind, instead of going, oh no, it's here again, I'll never get rid of it, all the rest of it, recognizes this is a conditioned arising right now of this particular thought, this particular emotion, this particular memory. Let me just work with it in real time. I understand what it is. I understand where it's come from. I have the intention and the inclination of mind to work with this skillfully, while it's here, in the same way I would work skillfully with this state or this emotion if it arose from any other source. It's just an emotion. It's just a body sensation. It's just a thought. Right? And over time, this stuff starts to lose its specialness. Then it becomes, when aspects of this may seemingly re-arise, it's just more routine dukkha. You know, regular dukkha. So, we learn to work with these things with love without closing around them or identifying with them, and recognize that this is like a form of karmic residue, you know, like this space junk that periodically goes through orbit. You know, it's there, and then it's gone, it's gone. Taking care to notice when it's gone. There's a certain way in which sometimes we talk about it, our experiences, and we'll say something like, it's always there, blah, 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 but it's always there. This and this and this and this, but it's always there. So a good Dharma teacher might say to you, well, show it to me. Because our understanding is, or our way of working with things is, when it's there, and when it's not, which is a much easier way to hold these things, right? When anger is there, anger is there. When happiness is there, happiness is there. When sadness is there, sadness is there. When joy is there, joy is there. We don't get so much into, but it's always there. It's not manifest. I can't put my finger on it. But somehow, it's there. A Dharma teacher would be inclined to say, it's not there. When it's there, it's there. When it's not, it's not. So we can commit ourselves to continue to work with these states in a way that supports our own liberation. And, you know, that might involve something like getting additional support, you know, something like working with a psychotherapist or doing some somatic experiences to help body understand how to work with trauma responses or something like that, or, you know, committing to sobriety or entering treatment, all the rest of it. So, and just to say something briefly about the area of reconciliation. Does forgiveness mean that you need to, like, set up a weekly coffee date? No. Right? You don't necessarily have to have any kind of relationship with somebody that's been part of this experience for you. You may or you may not. I mean, there can be beautiful examples of reconciliation between people where there's been harm. You know? Parents that, you know, were alcoholic and irresponsible when their children were growing up, and then at a certain point they, you know, get sober and, you know, come to their children after they've done their work and take responsibility and all the rest of it. Sometimes there can be a rejoining in that kind of way. Sometimes, no way. It would be completely unwise. So, you know, letting go, forgiving, doesn't necessarily have to take any particular kind of form. That's really a discernment and a wisdom kind of question. But it's mostly about your repair of your relationship to your own heart-mind and then acting skillfully out of that as is appropriate. So more can be said on this topic, which is vast and deep. But I thought it was useful to go into it tonight, because tomorrow, you know what's coming tomorrow? That would be the difficult person. And, you know, there'll be some guidance in the morning about how to select that person and how to hold that whole category of people as you go along with your metta practice. There's a certain kind of way in which we need to see the truth of the Buddhist teachings, where he makes this big distinction between the kind of suffering that's suffering, profitless, pointless, useless, don't get anything out of it, and the potential of relating to suffering in a way that actually is enlightening, strengthening, onward leading, freeing. And, you know, the big difference is the mind relating to suffering with wisdom and compassion, or is it taking a different attitude and approach towards it? So this talk was really an attempt to give some framing around this particular topic and coaching about my understanding about what the Buddha would say in relationship to this topic of forgiveness. May the many seeds of the wholesome which we've planted here today come to fruition and be known in our heart, minds, in this very life. And may the merit of the practice that we've done be a cause and condition of our own awakening and that of all beings.